Om Vasudevendra Yogindram Natva Jnana Pradam Guru Mukshunam Hitarthaya Tattva Bodho Vidhiyate. We've graduated to doing it together now. Tataha Sushuptyavastha Ka Tataha Sushuptyavastha Ka Aham kim apina janami, aham kim apina janami, sukhena maya, sukhena maya, nidra anubhuyate, nidra anubhuyate, iti sushupti avastha, iti sushupti avastha. Karna sharira bhimanyatma prajna iti uchate karna sharira abhimani atma prajna iti uchate. We've seen that I, as a jiva, am called Vishwaha when I am associated with the stula sharira. Stula sharira abhimani atma vishwaha iti uchate. And that accounts for the waking experience. Shrotradi jnanendriyahi shabdadi vishayaha jnayate iti yat sa jagra avastha. The jagra avastha, the waking state, is a state in which I experience shabda sparsha rupa rasa gandha, these objects in the world in the waking state. Swapna avastha is, on the other hand, an experience of internal phenomena, memories of things that have been experienced throughout the day. And they're stored in the chittam, they're stored in the mind, along with the unconscious and the subconscious. So last week we said that Vedanta is not interested in dream analysis. The purpose of looking at the experience of dreaming is to understand the Atma, to understand, am I a dreamer? Am I a waker? And so they have a model. The Shastra presents a model regarding what the dream experience is. There are other models about what dreaming is. And we talked a little bit about how useful it might be to look at some dreams if you have a very powerful emotional dream, to look at how you feel about the actions, the people, even the colors and the fragrances, because there's the unconscious that's revealing itself, perhaps, in dream experience. Sometimes that's a useful practice. And then we looked a bit at why Swapna is, in a sense, the Achilles heel of this creation, because it gives us another perspective on the reality, on our experience of reality. Because we take this world to be very permanent and substantial and real because we can feel it with our senses. When we get hit by a waking brick, it really hurts. But when we look at the dream experience, when we get hit by a dream brick, it really hurts as well. When I fall down off a cliff in a dream, I become very frightened, and that's a real experience. And yet, the truth of that dream is only me. For example, if you're walking through a meadow, I am both the abhinna nimitta and upadana karanam for that dream. I am the actual material out of which this dream is created, and I am the one who creates the dream. I am the nimitta karanam. I am the Ishvara of my dream. Because when I look at everything in the dream, every blade of grass is nothing but me, consciousness, plus name and form. Everything in that dream, even other people. For example, if I meet a friend in a dream, is that friend really there? That friend comes from my own imagination, from my own experience, from my own memories. And yet, that friend, that person is a conscious being within that dream. And I am that consciousness. I, the dreamer, am the truth of that consciousness that expresses itself through my friend's upadhi. We'll talk about upadhi today. Through my friend's body and mind and thoughts and feelings. And so if I'm walking down a meadow and I see a Swami coming, and the Swami says, hey, well, look at this, look at this. Look, Tattvamasi, you are the truth of this entire world. You are the truth of this entire creation. There is nothing, there's no name and form, no experience, no person which is separate from you, because you lend your existence to everything in this dream. You lend your consciousness to everything in this dream. Now, consciousness does not manifest through a rock. The rock in a dream does not have a sukshma sharira, if you will, a dream sukshma sharira. Your friend has a dream sukshma sharira and manifests as a conscious person. You are the truth of that person. Sarvatma buddhi, it's easy to have upon reflection in regards to a dream, sarvatma buddhi, the buddhi, the knowledge that sarvatma, I am the self of everyone, because I see that nothing is separate from me. I am the consciousness that's expressed in everybody in my dream, and I'm the material cause. No single blade of grass is separate from my existence. I am the abhinna upadana karanam. I am the one who is the material cause of that dream creation. I am the creator of that dream too. I am the one who creates the dream. And so when we look at the experience of waking versus dream, dream is a subjective reality. Waking, there seems to be an objectivity. It's not a subjective reality. There's a shared common experience. And yet, we shouldn't mistake a shared common experience that's physically tangible through the five senses as being real, especially in relation to me, because I am the in the waker. I am the in the dreamer. I am the one consciousness. I am the sakshi. I am the one who's present in the presence of the dream and in the presence of the waking state. Waking state and dream state are mutually exclusive. They don't coexist, all things being equal. So what does not change is more real than that which changes. I, as a conscious being, I as the I as the sakshi, the witness, the perceiver of the waking phenomena and of the dream phenomena, I am the one which doesn't change. These shove each other away. These mutually displace one another. But I don't go when the dream goes. I don't go when the waking state goes. I'm the one that transitions from waking to deep sleep to dream and then back again. Which means that waker and dreamer are not intrinsic attributes of me, of consciousness. Because if something is an intrinsic attribute, intrinsic property, it doesn't come and go. Wetness doesn't leave water. Heat, hotness doesn't leave fire. Consciousness does not leave the waking state or the dreaming state. But the experience, the state, changes, and they mutually exclude one another. So this is the avastatraya viveka, the discrimination that occurs within the three states, regarding the three states, the discriminative analysis. And we have one more left. Tataha sushupti avastha ka. What is the sushupti avastha? Aham kimapi na janami, sukena maya nidra anubhuyate iti sushupti avastha, karana sharira abhimani atma pragniha iti uchate. So he asks after that, what is the sushupti avastha? Avastha means state. Here it means a state of experience. Sushupti. Supti itself means sleep. Sushupti, the sukara, the syllable su before it, for the word, is meant to indicate deep sleep, dreamless sleep, non-REM sleep, I think they may call it. So it could be the state which is characterized by snoring, but that is not an intrinsic characteristic of the deep sleep state. What is the intrinsic experience of the deep sleep state? Now, he doesn't get technical here. He takes this just from a simple experiential perspective. He says, Kimapi aham na janami. I don't know anything. Janami, I know. Najanami. I don't know. I don't know. What don't I know? Kimapi, nothing. I don't know anything. Aham, I, Najanami. I don't know anything. And Sukhena Maya Nidra Anubhuyate. Nidra, deep sleep, is Anubhuyate, is experienced, Maya, by me, Sukhena, happily. Iti Sushupti Avastha. This is the deep sleep state. So two things. I'm utterly ignorant, and I'm utterly happy. In the end, even though we might find hundreds of things to do instead of going to sleep, in the end, when we go to sleep, it's a welcome experience. And what do I experience in deep sleep? I don't experience anything. I don't experience anything. In fact, what I experience is just the karana sharira, is just pure ignorance. In other words, I experience the absence of all particular experiences. Because in the waking state, we have such a kaleidoscopic myriad of shabda, sparsha, rupa, rasa, gandha, all these forms and colors and sensations, all these objects. I mean, you look around, there's infinite, everything is just an infinite number of little tiny experiences, little tiny things to experience through all of our senses, through our multimedia input mechanisms, which are the jnanendriyas. In the dream state, we have all these experiences as well. Some of them are very fanciful. I had a dream a few nights ago that I saw a dog with a mustache. I don't know. And it was a very nice mustache. It was a big mustache. The rest was shaven. I didn't analyze that dream either. I didn't think it was worth it. I just laughed. When you have flying dreams or dreams that you just wake yourself up laughing, you know that things are good in your life. So, but in deep sleep, what do I experience? I don't experience anything in particular, right? The ego is there in a subtle way. The ahankara still remains because I'm still the sleeper. But we wake up and say, I slept like a log. This takes some time to really appreciate, but like going into an empty room. If you didn't experience the room, you couldn't say that it was empty. If you didn't go into a deep sleep state and experience the absence of anything in particular, no knowledge, just complete ignorance, I didn't know anything, I knew nothing specifically, then I wouldn't be able to recollect it. In other words, to recollect something, to recollect something, I have to collect it in the first place. And so I'm there in that experience state of deep sleep. Although there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to write home about because there's nothing there that I can talk about other than I didn't know anything. Sukhena Maya, happily by me, it is Nidra is experienced. So it's a pleasurable experience. What makes sleep unpleasant is if you keep waking up or if you have nightmares or if you ate that one too many puri and you can't sleep because of stomach problems. But otherwise, sleeping is a very pleasant experience. And it is called prajna. And these technical terms, the waker in the Shruti is called Vishwaha, the complete person, because the waking experience is actually informed by the Karana Sharira, the Sukshma Sharira, and the Stula Sharira. In the waking state, you're fully dressed. You're Vishwaha. You're completely dressed up because you're firing in all three bodies, all three cylinders, so to speak. So you're called Vishwaha. Taijasa, the dreamer is called Taijasa in the Shastra because it's a effulgent being, Tejas. Tejomaya is Taijasa, the one who is effulgent because your dream experience, it's as though you're living in a world of just light because it's all just an ephemeral manifestation from your own mind stuff. It's just mind stuff that you illumine and you inhabit and you create and you participate in. But you are the sakshi of that. And you as a dreamer are called Taijasa. So to hear, the deep sleeper is called Prajnaha. Prajnaha iti uchate. Prajnaha has several meanings, but the simplest, most straightforward one is Prayena Agniha iti. Agniha, Gnyaha janami, I know. Na janami, I don't know. Agniha, Agniha is an ignorant one. Ignorant one. Prayena, more or less. Prayena agniha, iti prajnaha. The one who is more or less ignorant. Now, he's ignorant because all he experiences is ignorance, is this karana sharira, which we saw is just a vidya rupa. If you remember from a couple classes ago, karana sharira is a vidya rupa, and it is atma swarupa ajnana. It is the ignorance of the nature of myself, and is anirvacha anadi avidya. It is ignorance which has no beginning and which cannot be said to be real or unreal. So it's in the deep sleep, we're just with the karana sharira. In our experience, the physical body is gone. In our experience, the dream world is gone. So in our experience, the sthula and sukshma sharira resolve into the karana sharira. All that is there is just this potential me. This subtle vritti, they say, because I'm still there. I'm still there and I can manifest. If I hear a loud sound, boom, I'm back. And I'm fully awake and jumping out of bed and wondering what happened. But in this deep sleep state, it's just the causal body. It's just the experience of the karana sharira. So the karana sharira abhimani atma prajnaha iti uchite. The self, when associated, abhimani, when identified or associated with the karana sharira, is called prajnaha. And that's a technical term. And we'll talk about where these terms come from in a moment. The purpose of looking at these three states, the waking, dream, and deep sleep state, is to fully understand the details of all of them, right? It's a trick question. No. It's not to fully understand the details of what it really means to be a waking person or a dreaming person or a sleeping person. It's to understand the Atma. It's to understand the nature of the self. And so this Sakshi, Avastatraya Sakshi, in the definition we're talking about, we're still going back to this initial fourfold definition of the self, which is the one who is stula sukshma karna sharirat yatiriktaha, the one who is distinct from the three bodies, the one who is avastatraya sakshi. That's where we are right now. Sakshi means the witness. So is Atma a witness? We attribute the state of being a witness to consciousness in respect to things witnessed. But witnessing, observing, is not the intrinsic nature of Atma. So oftentimes the Shruti will take a provisional stance to get you from point A to point B, to get you from a grosser perspective to a more subtle perspective. In fact, what we're going to see in the next section when we talk about the Panchakoshas, the Taittiriya Upanishad says, you are the body, the Atma is the body. And then it'll say, oh, well, no, because someone inhabits that body. You are the subtle body in various forms of the koshas, etc. So it'll say, no, you are the pranas. No, you are the mind. No, you are the intellect, etc. So in a sense, the sakshitvam, the state of being a witness to these states of consciousness, is one, not to fully elaborate on the details of these three experiences. And it's not really to say that my inherent nature is a sakshi, is a witness. Because my inherent nature is sat chit ananda swarupaha. I am chit. Consciousness is not inherently an a seer. Witness means a seer. So they use this drishtanta, this example, like the sun. The sun, when it illumines the earth, is an illuminator. The flashlight illumines the dark corner. The sun illumines the moon, illumines the earth, illumines the solar system. But by itself, the sun is just prakashatmaka, is just a prakasha swarupa. It's just of the very nature of light itself. And it's only in reference to the things illuminated or illumined do we call it an illuminator, something which illumines. But it's not an inherent attribute of itself. But to see that the sun is just pure light, we can start at looking at the reflected light in the moon, the reflected light in the earth. And we can say that the lit earth is the sun. I'm pushing this drishtanta a little further than I've heard other people go, but it might work. The sunlight is the light that illumines the earth. And the sunlight, the nature of that light of the sun can be found in the illumined earth. And the sun is, if you trace that light back, the sun is the illuminator of the earth. But in and of itself, the sun is just light itself. It's just brightness itself. So it's from the perspective, we take a provisional perspective and say it illumines the earth in and of itself without these upadhis, and we'll talk about what an upadhi is, without these limiting adjuncts, without these things that it illumines, it is just pure light. So too, there's a story of Swamiji, and I guess in the West, somebody, some reporter or something asked him, so are you a guru? And Pooja Swamiji says, no, I'm just a human being. In relation to my students, I'm a teacher. In relation to my disciples, I'm a guru. But I'm just a person. So too, the Atma, the Ur, in the waker, dreamer, sleeper, that's a pointer to Shuddhatma, Nitya Shuddha Atma Satchidananda. That's a pointer to the eternally pure consciousness, which is present in everyone. And the reason I say pure and eternally, you have to be careful sometimes with this language, because Atma is never impure. Consciousness is never sullied. My thoughts come and go, like in today's meditation. Agitation comes, fear comes, distraction comes, disappointment comes. All these come, all these go. And I am the quiet, I am the silence. I am the silent consciousness that is in between each thought, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Ishaya Namaha, and is present in every thought, because thoughts do not displace consciousness. Thoughts do not sully consciousness. Thoughts do not change the nature of who I am. I am Nitya Shuddha. I am eternally unsullied. I am never touched, asangoham. I am never dirtied. I am never stained by any thought and any state. Any state comes and goes. I don't come and go. Even though when we wake up sometimes, you ever had a dream where you wake up and it was so real that you wake up and you're still kind of scared, or you wake up and you're still laughing, you know, or you're about to fall and you wake up, or you're jumping in a horse, or you were flying in the air and you come back to the waking state and you go, wow, I was flying. Sometimes you almost think you can fly when you wake up. You don't try it at home. Don't try this at home, but you haven't quite woken up. There's a hangover. It's like when we come home from work. When we come home from work, there's so many things that we just need to process. We just can't let them go. There's things that I have to plan for tomorrow. There's conversations that I should have done differently before. Oh my goodness, you know, I have this project pending. There's all these thoughts that just grab us and don't seem to let go. But like in meditation, I can welcome them. Ah, there you are. Oh, there's anxiety. Oh, there's concern. Oh, there's sadness. It's not a judgment in terms of a condemnation. It's an acknowledgement of a recognizable pattern in the mind. Oh, the mind is prone to remembering, to regret about the past, to anticipating the future, to planning, to being nervous, to being satisfied, to being fill in the blank. And yet, as I see them, as I see these emotions and these thoughts, they come and inevitably they're going to go. And I am there watching. I am there present. They're not separate from me, but I am free from them because I am that one which illumines all the thoughts in the waking state, in the dream state, and even in the deep sleep state. So if we chunk our experiences, you can chunk your experiences in different ways. You can chunk your experience in moment by moment. Oh, here's a happy thought. Here's a sad thought. Here's a dull thought. Here, oh, now my mind is brilliant. Oh, now my mind is dull. Oh, I'm the most intelligent person in the world. Oh, I'm such a failure. I'm a success. I'm dumb. Every moment we're identifying with something that's going on. And one way to chunk these things is, I find, to label them in a non-judgmental way, in the sense of, here's this phenomenon, here's this phenomenon, here's this phenomenon. Oh, that's familiar. Oh, that's familiar. And once you become familiar with, oh, there's fear. Oh, welcome. I know you. Come on. If you're judging yourself for being fearful or you're trying to push it away, you're just empowering those negative emotions. If you say, come on, bring it on. I'm not afraid of you. If you're not afraid of fear, then you're not afraid. And you can have fearlessly have fear. You can courageously have fear. You can fearlessly have fear. And that's courage. Another way to chunk our experiences is by the avastatraya, is by these three states. Because when you look at a 24-hour window from sunrise to sunrise, what do? We wake up. We go to sleep. We dream. We have deep sleep. We wake up. We go to sleep. We dream. We have deep sleep. That's our experience. That's our cycle. That's our natural circadian rhythm, I guess. The purpose of introducing this avastatraya sakshitvam, the state of being a sakshi for these three states, is just another way to look at anatma, to see that these experiences are not away from me. I'm not away from any experience, but I am not limited by these mutually exclusive experiences. And in fact, every thought is mutually exclusive. Every perception is mutually exclusive. In fact, what I'm looking at right now at time A is utterly different than what I'm looking at now in time B. Those are mutually exclusive. That perception was characterized by that time, and now this perception is characterized by this time. They're not the same. So we can analyze our experiences in different ways. Avastatraya sakshitvam is one of those. So we have three states of experience. And in the waking state, we're associated with the gross body, and the other two come along. We fully inhabit all three. Dream state two, deep sleep state one. Now, these bodies, which are responsible for these experiences, are also called upadhi. There's a technical term called upadhi, which is very useful to understand and to use. Upadhi is sometimes translated as an apparently limiting adjunct, A-D-J-U-N-C-T, an adjunct, an apparently limiting adjunct. And in Sanskrit, it's upasamipe stitva swagunan adhate eva iti. So upadhi, this physical body is an upadhi. This sukshma sharira is upadhi. This karana sharira is upadhi. So upa means samipa. Remember that because it'll come up again today. Upa means samipa. So it means near. Samipa means vicinity. Samipe means in the vicinity. That's the definition of the prefix upa. Upa. Samipe stitwa. Staying close by, in near proximity. Swagunan adhate. It gives its qualities as though eva to that thing. That's upadhi. And upadhi is something which imparts its qualities to another by staying close to it. Okay? So the famous example is a crystal ball. You put a red flower behind it. So now this crystal is red, right? Now we have a red crystal. So by the flower remaining close to the crystal in a certain way, it imparts redness to the crystal. Is the crystal actually red? No. So the technical terms are the flower is the upadhi, the thing which lends its qualities to something else. The upahita, the thing that is apparently qualified, modified by the upadhi, is the crystal. And the aupadhika dharma, the characteristic, the attribute of the upadhi is the redness. So we have the redness, which is enjoyed by the flower, and that redness is apparently imparted to the crystal because it's close by. Upa samipe stitva, staying nearby, swagunan upadate eva, it as though lends its attributes, gives its attributes to that thing. So to the atma. So the atma, myself, I take on the quality, the characteristic of being a waker. How do I do that? I do that through the proximity of the sthula sharira, stula sukshma karana sharira in the waking state. So this body is the upadhi. This body is the upadhi, right? And the crystal is the atma, nitya shuddha atma, the eternally pure, clear consciousness. This consciousness as though takes on the form of the body, and it as though takes on the characteristics, as this crystal apparently takes on the characteristics of this flower, the redness, so too I, Shuddha Chaitanya, apparently take on the characteristics of this body. And when that happens, I am called the waker, Vishwa. So it's due to the upadhi that I become a waker. It's due to the upadhi that I become a dreamer. It's due to the upadhi that I become a sleeper. But when I say I become, remember it's eva. This is a very important word, eva, as though. Eva means like. It's as though. It's as though I become a dreamer, a waker, and a sleeper. But in reality, the crystal never becomes red. In reality, the sun is not really even an illuminator. I am not a waker. I am the I am the sakshi. I am the conscious being that's present in all experiences. And I'm not this turiya avastha that is separate from any of them. So this prakriya, this teaching methodology, this method of analysis, this method of vichara, comes directly from the Mandukya Upanishad, as we mentioned. And it talks about Omkara, Om Iteta Rakshanamidam Sarvam. It's Om is all of this. Om is the name of Brahman. And we can meditate upon reality, on our experience, as on Brahman, as Akara, Ukara, Makara, as the letter A, U, and M. And on those, we can superimpose in a meditative and vichara way, if you will, the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. A, U, Ma, Om. And this technical terminology, Vishwa, Taijasa, and Prajna, that comes from this Upanishad. And the Upanishad talks about Turiya, a fourth, but we have to be very clear. Turiya is not a fourth state. It can be considered the fourth in the way that silence can be considered the fourth sound in Omkara. So when you chant Om, you hear the Akara Ukara, which is turns into the guna, the letter O, plus makara, om, om. Is there a fourth sound? The Upanishad talks about this fourth. What is this fourth of om? This fourth is not a separate state. This fourth seems to exist between chants, as we did in meditation today, om ishaya namaha. Om Ishaya Namaha, it appears to exist between chants. Silence appears to exist between chants. I am that silence, which is the nature of consciousness that exists between chants, which exists between thoughts. But really, the chant does not displace my silent consciousness, which I am. Just as the waking state does not displace consciousness, which I am, does not the dream state, the deep sleep state, do not displace me. I inform, I lend my existence and consciousness to every experience, whether it be a waking dream or deep sleep. So this turiya needs to be understood very carefully, because if atma, if the truth of myself is a state, then I come and go. And if I come and go, I am not tattva. And this book is called Tattva Bodha. And what we're doing is tattva viveka, what exists, trikalepi tishtati iti sat, that which exists in all three periods of time is sat. If I come and I go, I am not sat, then what am I? I'm just another experience. Some people come to Vedanta with the expectation that we need to reach a fourth experience. And the truth of the matter is, as taught by the Shastra, as taught by the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, and by our teachers and the whole teaching lineage, is that you don't need a new experience. You need to understand the present experience. I need to see that I am the unchangeable truth in every experience, waking, dream, or deep sleep. Now, that radically changes my experience. Ajivan Muktaha, one who is free in this life, his experience is radically different. But it's not because he experienced this fourth state of consciousness. He realized that the truth of this entire creation, this truth of Bhagavan, the truth of myself, never goes. The one thing that never goes in any experience is me. And the truth of me is not the witness. The truth of me is existence and consciousness, which is limitless. When I know myself to be limitlessness itself, my experience is radically different. What need have I for this? What need have I for that? I can embrace the entire world. I can love the entire world. I am the entire world. There is no difference between me and Bhagavan. When I see that, it doesn't matter if I'm waking or dreaming or deep sleep. In fact, I've had dreams where I hear the Mahavakya. When you're in a class and you start seeing some of this clearly, your mind resolves just into the very quietude that you are. Now, that is not a new experience that causes liberation. That is just a recognition. It's natural for the mind when it comes home just to take a deep breath and relax because it's home. And that homeness, that at-homeness, is what we're searching for in every experience. It's not in every unique experience. And the problem is we think we'll find it in novelty. We'll think we'll find it in novel experiences, unique new experiences. Oh, my old experiences are not great. Oh, I've been to Yosemite. Let me go to Yellowstone now. Oh, I've been to Rishikesh. Let me go to Varanasi now. New. Let me be a global traveler. I need no new unique experience. What I need is an appreciation of my current experience. So this turiya should be understood very carefully. It is not saying that it's a fourth experience, a fourth state of consciousness, that it's a samadhi experience. A quiet mind, a sattvaka buddhi, one who has the qualifications, can appreciate the truth right now, right here. So please appreciate this avastatraya vichara in its proper context, and the result is that understanding. Now, what is the context here? The context here, just to reiterate, this is the end of the avastatraya vichara. Okay? So now, where are we? Let's reset, let's recalibrate a little bit. So this tattva-bodha literally means tattva-bodha, means knowledge of the truth. And we gain this knowledge of the truth through tattva-vivekaha, through a discriminative analysis of what's real and what's not real. And so this book is divided up into three parts. The first part is the adhikaratva. Who is the qualified student? We looked at that. Viveka vairagya, shamadamadi, shatka sampatihi, and mukshutvam. Who is this for? And then there's this tattva vivekaha. What is that? And so that is the second part. And then at the end, the last section is going to be jnanapalam. What you get out of this knowledge, what a realized person sees. It's one of the most beautiful sentences I've ever seen at the end of this text. So stay tuned. Now this tattva vivekaha in itself, this middle section, so there's the qualifications, there's the tattva viveka, and then there's the palam. We're looking at the result. We're in the middle section. And this middle section is threefold. Tvam pada vichara, tat pada vichara, and asi or aikyam vichara. It's all modeled directly on how the Upanishad unfolds this vision. In a Mahavakya, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. It's an equation. Tat tvam asi. You are that. You are the cause of this world. You are one with Ishvara. That is a Mahavakya. It's an equation. And so we need to understand, because our experience is not that I am the truth of this universe. My experience is that I'm this little person with these little experiences and scrambling after these little shiny things and until this one's over. And then I come back, keep desiring these little tiny things until I stop and go, wait a minute. And I stop and listen to the teaching. To the teacher, to a wise one. And what they'll do, what the Shastra does, it breaks this vichara into three parts. What is the nature of myself? Tvampada vichara. What is the nature of Ishvara, the cause of this creation? Everything that I experience? Tatpada vichara. Tvam, tat, Tvam asi, you are that. Tvam, what do you mean by you? What do I mean by me? Tat, what do I mean by that? And asi, you are. The second person singular verb to be, us. Asi, you are that. That's talking about the aikyam, the oneness between those two things. That's the equation of Vedanta. That's the entirety of Vedanta. If you get that, you get Vedanta. Not just theoretically, because this is not a theoretical knowledge, because it's talking about me and every experience I have in the waking dream and deep sleep. So a way to enliven this teaching is by these methods of inquiry. So right now we are still in the first part of this, the Tvampada Vichara, what is the nature of the self? We will talk about the Tatpada, which will mean, how does this creation come about and who is Ishvara? And then what is the Asi? How do we say that you are equal to the Lord? My goodness, blasphemy. There's beautiful ways to talk about this. And the key, of course, is where does the I land? Right? Where does the meaning of that land? And how do we look at the, not the Vachartha, but the Lakshartha, the implied meaning of these words? So really what we're doing now is understanding the I. Where does the I land? And that's why we have these different methods. And there's a fourfold definition. This is the complete definition in this text of aham, of the Tvampada Vichara. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. What is the nature of that I? The nature of that I is stula sukshma karna sharirat yatiriktaha. I am distinct from these three bodies. I am the avastatraya sakshi. I am the witness to these three states of experience. And the next one he's going to take is the pancha kosha atitaha. I am beyond. I transcend the five koshas. And it's another way to look at the same phenomenon. So in the Tvampada Vichara portion of this text, he gives four definitions, three of which talk about anatma. I'm not this, I'm not this, I am not this. Like the tenth man. Counting out the nine other boys. The tenth man's not that, not that, not that, not that, not that. These are three ways to do that. The fourth one, he says, Satchidananda Sarupaha Atma Asmi. Atma, aham, I am this Atma, which is the nature of Satchidananda Sarupaha. So that is the Sarupa Lakshana. That is the direct indicator for the truth of the self. And there's a beautiful way to unfold that as well. So that's the context of where we are now. And we're going to start the last of the Anatma Vichara, the Panchakosha Titaha. Now, I've talked a little bit about Upanishads. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more so we understand, because this teaching methodology is directly from the Upanishads. So what we saw with the Avastatraya Sakshitvam is directly from the Mandukya Upanishad. What we're going to see coming up with the Panchakosha Titaha, the nature of the self being free from the five koshas, is directly from the Taittiriya Upanishad. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what an Upanishad is, because an Upanishad is not different from this Tathagata. This Tathagata is a Prakarana Granta. It's considered an introductory text, but there's all kinds of Prakarana Granthas, but they're distillations and representations of the same material that's in the Upanishads. So Vedanta has this Prasthanatraya. The three sources for this vision are the Upanishads, which are the Shruti Granthas, the books which are revealed, that exist in the Veda, and that is the Upanishads. There's Smriti Grantha, the Bhagavad Gita that's in the Mahabharata, in the Itihasa and Puranas. And lastly, there's the Nyaya Granthas. There's a logical, analytical text, such as the Brahma Sutra. And this Prasthanatraya, this threefold basis of this teaching, are the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutra. And there's no difference between the three. The Brahma Sutra shows, really, in a very analytical way, what the Upanishads are saying. The Gita says nothing other than what the Upanishads say. So really, the primary source is this revealed Upanishad. And the word Tattva Bodha, knowledge of the truth, is the book that gives that knowledge of the truth. Right? This book is the giver of the knowledge of the truth, because its topic is the knowledge of the truth. So too with Upanishad. As you may or may not know, there's four Vedas. There's the Rig, Yajus, Sama, and Atharva Veda. And these are considered revealed texts. They come with the creation. They're directly seen by the rishis, by the mantra-triks. And the yajus, there's two recensions. There's a Shukla and Krishna Yajurveda. The Taittiriya we study is from the Krishna Yajurveda. So there's four Vedas, and each Veda has four sections. There's a Samhita, Brahmana, Aranika, and Upanishad. So the Samhita are the verses themselves that are used in the rituals and the chanting. The Brahmanas are understanding the rituals philosophically. The Aranikas are Upasana-based and meditations on that. And some of this Brahma Vidya, and then there are the Upanishads, which are Vedanta. The Upanishads are Vedanta, Vedanam Antaha, Vedasya Antaha. At the end of the Vedas, at the end of these four books, there's the Vedanta. Okay? And there are considered to be 108 Upanishads. And 10 of the most frequently studied are those that are commented on by Adi Shankaracharya. So his famous works are the commentaries on these 10 Upanishads, on the Bhagavad Gita and the Brahma Sutra. Many other texts are attributed to Adi Shankaracharya. This text is attributed to Adi Shankaracharya. Bhajagovindam, there's numerous texts that are attributed to Shankaracharya. He's just a brilliant saint, considered an avatar of Shiva. He set up and organized the monastic tradition, the Dashanami order in India, and he established these four mutts, these four centers of learning. These 10 Upanishads are Isha Kena Katha Prashna Mundaka Mandukya Taittiriya Aitareya Chandogya and Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. These are the 10 primary Upanishads, and they're considered primary because they are commented on by Adi Shankaracharya. Now, the other ones are Upanishads as well. Mahanarayana Upanishad, beautiful to chant. There's so many beautiful chants in the Narayana Upanishad. Kaivalya Upanishad. Sadhus are said to chant the Kaivalya Upanishad daily because it's very succinct and very beautiful. There's 108 Upanishads total. And there's a long commentary tradition because Shankara wrote a commentary and then people wrote sub-commentaries and other acharyas and sadhus wrote other commentaries. There's vartikas and vrittis and karikas, different types of commentaries. And the very meaning of Upanishad is exactly the same as the meaning of Tattvabodha. So let's briefly look at that. Upa means samipa. Do you remember when I said upadhi? Upadhi meant Upa means samipe stitva, that which remains close, right? For an upadhi, that which remains close and gives its attributes to another thing, like the flower gave the attribute of redness to the crystal. That nearness, that proximity, is the upa and upa ni shad. So there's three parts of this word, upa ni shad. So shad is sad. Dhatu is the verbal root, and it turns into sha because of santi, because of grammatical changes. But upa means something that is near, samipa, samipyam, that which is near. What's near? The self. What's the nearest thing? The nearest thing to me is the self, Atma. So here in the word Upanishad, upa means Atma. Ni means nishchayartha or nishchitam jnanam. Nishchitam jnanam is clear knowledge. Nishchitartha is a clear understanding of the meaning of the truth of something. Nishchita jnanam, a clear knowledge. A clear, firm, steady knowledge. So upa ni means a clear knowledge of the self. A clear knowledge of the self, a clear knowledge of truth. Knowledge of truth, Tattvabodha. So there's a direct relationship there, just with upani. And now we have the dhatu sad. Sad. In the Dhatupada, which is a book of verbal roots, it's actually shadlr. Shadlr. And the sh and the lr at the end are technical grammatical changes that are given to certain roots because they do certain things in certain situations grammatically. So semantically, they're not right important for this discussion. But this knowledge of the self, this clearly ascertained knowledge of the self, what does it do? Well, you look at the dhatu sad. in this Dhatupada, in this book of verbs, it gives three meanings. It gives visharana, gati, and avasadana. So the sad is used in various different contexts, of course, not just in this one word, but it has these three meanings. It has visharana, it has gamana, and avasadana. And at the very end, it has a quip suffix. This is a bit technical, but if you know some Sanskrit, it's very interesting. A quip suffix is a suffix which comes and goes and gives a meaning. Because you look, Upanishad, it ends in dakara or takara, right? It ends in that. There's nothing at the end there. But technically what's happened is there's been a quip suffix, a suffix that comes, and it gives the sense of agency to that word. So it's like the word cook, right? When you say, oh, he's a cook, really what you mean is he's a cooker. He's someone who cooks. It's like he's a seer, he's a hearer. Well, that ER is there, that he's the agent of seeing, he's the agent of hearing. But when you have cooker, that's a rice cooker, that's not the person. But we have the word cook, and you can think about that as well. That probably may have been cooker, and then he dropped the ER. It might be fanciful, I don't know. But it's the same idea here. Sud, this quip, sud plus quip. So the word is upa, ni, sud, quip. The quip comes, gives a sense of agency to that word, and then goes away, it disappears. And so it means it does those things that the dhatu, the verbal root, does. And the three things that verbal root does is visharana, gamana, and avasadana. Visharana means anartha vratan visharati. It means it loosens, it disintegrates. It loosens the warp and woof of samsara. It's like a thread, and through this knowledge of the self, through this analysis like we're doing of atma anatma vichara, we take the threads of the cloth of samsara and we slowly start pulling them away, and we loosen the threads and we loosen the cloth until it finally just resolves. It just goes away, samsara. So one meaning is that this atma jnanam visharati, it loosens and disintegrates samsara. That's what an Upanishad does. It loosens and disintegrates samsara. The next thing it does, it's gamanam, gatihi or gamanam. Gamana means going from the dhatu gam, to go. It means gaining. It gains atma. It means gaining the atma. It means brahma gamayati. So it causes one to go to Brahman. Gamanam. It causes one to go to Brahman. How do you go to Brahman? Well, you go down the corner and you make a left at the first stoplight, and you go down 2.5 miles, and you go, and then you make a right at the barn. How do you go to Brahman? You reach the fourth state of experience. You reach the fourth state of experience and everything transforms into Brahman. No. Through Upani. What does the leading to Brahman? What causes one to go? In other words, what takes one to Brahman? This upani, this atmajnanam, this tatvajnanam. So it's this knowledge which makes one appreciate that there's no place to go. That you are that truth through that knowledge, that well-ascertained knowledge of oneself, that upa, samipe, that thing which is the nearest to you. So that's the second meaning of sad dhatu, the gamanam. And then the third is avasadana. Avasadayati, it brings an end to something. It destroys something. It brings an end to samsara. So it completely brings an end to samsara. Samsara being the struggle to become different. Because if you don't recognize the truth of yourself as limitlessness at this moment, then you struggle to become different, because everything you take yourself to be, particularly in the waking state, because that's the one that counts, that's where we can gain moksha, is limited. Everything we take ourselves to be, we take ourselves to be the upadhis, this karya, karana, sanghata, this assemblage, sanghata, of the body, mind, senses, emotions, this complex, these upadhis, this upadhi. I take myself to be the redness of the flower, right? I take myself to be this upadhi. I take myself to be the characteristics of the upadhi. You know, if I had three flowers, a red flower, a yellow flower, and a white flower, and I held them behind the crystal, I would see that crystal as being white or red or yellow. they're apparently limiting or coloring adjuncts. Here, I take myself to be this body, I take myself to be this mind, etc. I take myself to be this stula, sukshma, karana, sharira. So it is this upani, this atmajnanam, this tatvajnanam, which does all three of these. It loosens the bonds of samsara. It makes one appreciate the truth of the moment of yourself as Brahman, and thereby bring an end to all struggle to be different. So the reason why we're introducing this now is because this Brahmatma Vidya, this Upani, this Atma Vidya is no different than the Tattva Bodha that we're talking about. And it's through the study of this text, which is a distillation of these methods to unfold this knowledge, that are presented in this Tattva Bodha, in this text here. And it's through this study that we gain Nishchaya Jnanam, this Nishchita Jnanam, this firmly ascertained knowledge, free from vagueness, free from doubt, and free from error. That's why we come back to this again and again, is because if we have vagueness regarding who I am, then Shravanam is the answer. Shravanam is listening to this, taking yourself for the ride, right? Letting yourself go with the analysis that the teacher is performing, the vichara. Because basically a teacher is taking the teaching of the text, of the shastra, and his own experience, and unfolding that vision so that if you follow along, if the student follows along as the teacher unfolds the vision, then that vision that comes from the shastra, that's seen by the teacher, becomes the student's vision. And if there's any vagueness, if the ahankara raises his head again and says, I'm fat, I'm thin, I'm stupid, I'm smart, ityadi, etc., then we come back and we listen again so we can see that again and again until when we walk out of the class, we can hold that vision. It isn't a matter for remembrance, but the habitual nature of the mind brings us back into this untrue notion that I am this limited being again and again. And immersing ourselves in the shravana removes that vagueness. And then we might have doubts, mananam. Well, we'll ask questions. In the Upanishads, and particularly in the bhashas and the commentaries, there's this dialogue, always asking questions. This is not a faith-based initiative. This is not a faith-based religion. This is not a religion. This is not a faith-based anything. This is an inquiry into the nature of reality, which is meaningful, because when that nature of reality is me, and it's the answer to all the struggles and all the strife I find, that's the value add. Samsara goes away. I am free. This is not intellectual. This is not theoretical. It's not a belief system. Therefore, it invites inquiry, questions. Mananam is a very important part of the sadhana, the second part of this threefold sadhana. And lastly, that exercise which removes vagueness. Shravanam removes error. Manana removes doubt. Nididhyasana removes vagueness. This habitual error, along with shravanam and mananam, they all remove error. There's quality of the mind called chitta naishchalyam and antakarana shuddhi, and we can talk about those. Antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, is developed through karma yoga. Chitta naishchalyam is developed through meditation. That's an ability to calm the agitated mind. Chitta naishchalya. Chalya means to move around. Naishchalya means an ability to sit, ability to keep the mind just in one place. Chitta, the mind. Chitta naishchalya. Having a non-distracted mind so I can just sit with the truth of myself in nididhyasana. So both being a karma yogi and being one who can meditate, one who has antakarana shuddhi and one who has chitta naishchalyam, gives one the tools, the personal tools, to enter upon a nididhyasana, a quiet appreciation of the truth of myself based on shravanam, which removes the error, the habitual error that I have about myself. If I take myself to be this karya karana sankata, if I take myself to be this upadhi, if I take myself to be yellow, red, or white, then I come back to Shravanam and I sit and I ask questions. Why do I take myself to be this? How can I not be yellow? How can this crystal not be red? I don't understand. It certainly looks red, doesn't it? I'm experiencing it as red. It seems to be red. I see it as red. It must really be red. No, no, no. Ask questions. And then once you see it, you sit with it and you bring it again and you bring it again and you own up this knowledge until when you say I, you can, in a functional, perfunctory way, say I'm walking to the store. You're not going to say this body walks to the store. But when you say I walk to the store, there's no problem there because you don't take yourself to be. You realize that you are the sakshi to this entire waking experience and you're the truth of this entire waking experience, this entire jagat, in fact, just like you, the dreamer, are the truth of the entire dream. Nididhyasana helps you appreciate that your relationship with this world is not significantly different than your true relationship with the dream world. Because when you look out, you see that you are the truth of this entire creation and that the cause of this creation, Bhagavan, is not separate from you and you are not separate. Aham Brahmasmi. I am that truth. And if in that Nididhyasana, which if you need it, it's a very useful thing to do. The knowledge comes from Shravanam because it's a means of knowledge. It's a pramana because the problem is ignorance. And once I remove the ignorance, I'm free. Sometimes the mind needs to catch up. And if the mind needs to catch up, there's Nididhyasana. So I hope this brief discussion of an Upanishad helps us appreciate that this Tattva Bodha is deeply rooted in the Upanishads. And we saw that this one prakriya, this avastatraya sakshitvam, is rooted in the Mandukya Upanishad. And next week we'll see how this panchakosha atita prakriya, this analysis, this teaching method, a method of unfolding that I am separate from these five koshas, how that comes from the Taittiriya Upanishad. Let's take a moment. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yankshobarahitaha Brahmanah Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Satgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishwara Arpanastu.
I have a question, or actually a thought. When you say, you know, we are not separate from Ishvara, and you know, we are nothing is really alienated from us. It's beautiful, but when I think when you during the course of the day or events in life, you witness also some individuals who exhibit some unfairness or adharma or inconsistency in their behavior or lack of truth, you know, not lack of transparency, things like that. How does one bring about the attitude that all of this is, you know, is still all, you know, that whole part, the disorder is also in keeping with order.
Yes.
Can you touch upon that a little? Help us understand. Understand. You know how to make sense of that.
At that time.
So when you're confronted with situations which are not in tune with Dharma, people who are acting in a selfish way, people are acting in a disingenuous way, right? They don't know Satyam Vada, right? They don't know to speak truth, to do ahimsa only. That's a challenge because we're kind of caught between two instincts or two desires. One is to right the wrong, right? We all have a sense of Dharma, and like Arjuna and the Pandavas, it can be our duty to right that wrong. Krishna came to, you know, reinstill Dharma when there was a Dharma. So promoting Dharma is a natural instinct in ourselves, and yet we have the struggle because we want to see that everything is prasadam. Everything, in a sense, is an expression of punya and papa. And if I can see everything as prasadam, then I am free from my reactivity and I become a karma yogi. Every experience is an opportunity to get a handle on my raga and dvesha, my reactiveness, my judgment, my all those negative qualities, to boost sattvaguna and to diminish rajas and tamas. So we're kind of in this struggle between wanting to create a better world. When we look out into the world, there's so much injustice there, environmentally, politically, socially, and then in our own sphere, people we interact with are often adharmic, often fool themselves thinking that they're right, thinking that they're doing something good. I know people who say, oh, I don't mind lying. It's just little lies. It makes my life easier. But they don't realize that people don't believe anything they say anymore because you don't know what's true and what's not true.
Right.
But it's a very subtle balance. And I've always found it a process of listening. Now, this is sort of on my own, how I approach some of these things, is that there's always this sort of tension between wanting to correct the situation and wanting to be free, even though I see that I need to correct the situation. So I see that I can be non-reactive. My ragas and dveshas I can manage even when I'm confronted with adharma, even when I'm dealing with bad people, in a sense, even when the situation is not how I wanted, because people are misusing their free will. And it's a matter of listening what my swadharma is in a given situation. Oftentimes, if someone is doing something that injures another person, if it's within my capacity to stop that person from doing it, I will do it. At least I'd hope that I would want to do it. I would try to do that. If someone is doing a situation that injures me, I can put a stop to that. If someone's throwing rocks at me, I can walk away or run away or tell them to stop throwing rocks or whatever. In a professional environment, if someone is causing havoc in two ways, one is maybe someone is attacking me, or someone's disingenuousness is causing the project to be put at risk, you know, there's a certain dharma there, there's a certain responsibility within that role to address that. And I believe that the effectiveness is a function of my acceptance and choice to act to correct, rather than being reactive. So I find that the more reactive I am in a situation, the less effective I am and the less efficacious the solution is if I'm reacting to the situation. If I have the inner quietude, if my ragas and dveshas, if I can process those feelings in meditation, do japa, remind myself that this is Bhagavan, there's a number of techniques to try to create a bhavana of non-resistance to whatever is happening, utter acceptance to everything that's happening, and then see what my role demands of me. Because I'm in a role. I'm in a role as an employee, let's say, and I have a responsibility to the employer to make this project successful. And if someone is getting in the way of that, then I need to find a way to correct the situation in the least harmful way that I can with ahimsa. And I find that I'm more effective and more creative in terms of finding a solution, the less of my own melodrama, the less of my own samsaratvam, the less of my own raga and dvesha I bring to that situation. Some situations call us, right? A lot of our prarabdha is because we're called to do certain things and we resonate with a certain role. Some people feel strongly, I need to save the whales. Some people feel strongly that I need to help the homeless or people who need food. We're called to do different things. If you're talking about a professional situation, then there's certain roles and responsibilities. Interpersonal situations. In a marriage, there's certain responsibilities and there's certain challenges in accepting other people as they are. I mean, I often have to question, is it my job to change that person? If I let that person, all things being equal, if I let that person be as they are in my heart and realize that person can have these characteristics, I don't need to be emotionally invested in them being any different, then I'm free in their presence. I can choose to maybe keep my distance, but I can still respond to them in a loving way. If they're doing something that's adharmic and I have no control to fix that situation, that's where frustration comes in, because I see that there's an adharmic situation that needs to be fixed and I don't have an ability to do that. And that's a real tough one, because you have the compassion for the situation, for the people in that situation, and you're at a loss as to how to resolve that. That's where your heart breaks, and that's where I think looking at the mystery of Bhagavan and accepting that is part of the sadhana. I don't know if that addressed your question. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on how to?
It really helps, especially the you know, the part that you shared on listening and the non-resistance, really bringing our own melodrama and raga-dvesha, you know, to a minimum. And then, you know, not being completely indifferent, but doing what is needed in that role and undertaking the corrective action without, you know, being blown away and getting really overwhelmed by our own resistance and melodrama.
Yeah.
That was very helpful.
Good. It's the sadhana. And it's difficult, because when you say, well, if I were to accept everything, then why would I do anything?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's your prarabdha. Your prarabdha calls you. Your prarabdha is threefold. It comes in three different ways. It comes through anyecha, anicca, and swecha. Your prarabdha manifests as anicca, something that just comes undesired. Not necessarily bad, but you don't ask for it. It just comes. Situations, the givens in your life. Your prarabdha is also manifest as anyecha, by other people's desires. Anya icha, by the desire of another. Someone asks you to come do something. Someone asks you to participate in something. And so your prarabdha, your karma for this life, your swadharma even unfolds through that. And also swecha, swa icha, one's own desire. Someone has a reoccurring interest in a certain thing. Something calls you, right? I need to save the whales, or I need to get rid of malaria. Then that's your prarabdha calling you. So your dharma is defined by your givens. And if you don't have a lot of givens pulling you, then you have more choice as to how you want to create the details of your life. But your prarabdha wakes you up every morning because there's stuff to do. And in situations, and especially in professional situations, it's difficult. I've had this conversation with Swami Vidyadhamananda. It's very difficult to keep one's calm and play one's role when things seem to be so important. And his response was, there's never a reason to be angry, meaning there's never a good reason to be reactive. He's such a sadhu. He was speaking from a complete sense of at-homeness and quietude, that he just responds to given situations and can do what he needs to do in a role, even if they're difficult, but he always responds from this sense of loving, giving, quietude. And that's our sadhana if we're not there.
I was just reflecting that the Sadhara Chatushtaya, which you mentioned earlier,
yes.
I think the more you are, you perfect yourself in the Sadhara Chatushtaya, I think the more effect or the more impact the teaching has on you. I think your manana becomes more powerful, and hopefully in time you really start living the truth rather than only hearing the truth and understanding the truth in an intellectual way. I was just reflecting on this particular aspect. I think many of us, as you just now pointed out, react rather than respond.
Yes.
And this is something that I think the control, the shama, dhamma, uparama, and the titiksha, and the nitya, nitya, vastu, vivekaha, I think comes into play. And I think thinking about these probably is, and the lessons that you learn, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, where you know, you understand that your gunas are making you do certain things, or make you react to certain things. And if you can transcend these, then probably slowly the effect of these teachings takes a much greater effect on you, and the teachings take a much greater effect on you. I was just reflecting on what you just now mentioned, the sadhana, as you mentioned. And that this teaching gives you a lot of insight into sadhana, which of course the teaching, the Tattva Bodha itself doesn't tell you how to become that adhikara.
Yes, yes.
But it's telling you first that is important. I think I just wanted to share that the feeling which I had.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because there's a good reason why the text starts off with the qualifications, the adhikaratvam. And those grow over time, and they're presented in different ways, and there are different tools to get that. The Gita is beautiful because it's both Yoga Shastra and Brahmajnanam. It talks about how to gain these qualities through karma yoga, through meditation. And it talks, like I said, about the gunas, like in chapter 14, the gunatraya vibhaga yoga, the nature of the three gunas, and there's different permutations of the gunas. We can talk about that maybe more next week. But, you know, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So it's sort of a twofold practice, right? One is we want to increase sattva guna, which is responsible for clarity and happiness and knowledge. And we want to become someone who's primarily sattva guna, secondarily rajas, and thirdly tamas. We wouldn't be able to sleep if we didn't have tamas in our lives. Mm-hmm. But there's all these permutations. Some people are rajas, tamas, sattva. Some people are rajas, sattva, tamas. Some people are tamas, rajas, sattva. And so we're in this journey of transformation, which is a journey towards adhikaratvam, which put another way is we're becoming karma yogis. Another way to look at it is the sadhana chatushtayam. And there's different ways to look at this. So we're in a process of transformation from the perspective of a jiva, all to create an inner disposition wherein we can see clearly that I am gunatitaha. I am beyond all these gunas, and the gunas act upon the gunas, and I am totally free regardless of what's happening in the mind. So it takes a certain sattva guna pradhanatvam, a certain predominance of a purity of mind, antakarana shuddhi, to be able to appreciate that in the end, I am free from whatever the mind is doing, even when the mind is agitated, even when the mind is sad. That's just a problem of the mind. That's not my problem. The more we're able to equip ourselves with these qualifications, the clearer this knowledge becomes. And like I mentioned a week or two ago, the more you sit with this teaching, the more there's a value for the qualifications, and the more the value of the values becomes clear. And so the amanatvam, adambitvam, ahimsakshantar, arjavam, ityadi, that all starts to become very real, and it has a real immediate payoff. You know, one's life, you kind of go back and forth. Oh, I'm really doing this karma yoga thing. You know, my duty calls me to be so engaged and you keep the thread of this vichara going. And other times you have more time to sit with this teaching and you're less active. I find that oftentimes people's lives sort of swing from pravritti to nivritti in different cycles. Sometimes we're very pravritti oriented. We're very engaged and we're very much pursuing this knowledge in a very active karma yogi approach. Maybe later in life or different times during our life, we have time to withdraw and just sit with this teaching more. And both the pravritti and nivritti cycles in our life add to the growth that we need for this jnana nishtha.
Thank you. We look forward to your recorded sessions, because I think, as you just mentioned, as I myself felt very strongly, the more and more you listen to it, the more and more you reflect on it, I think the more it sort of sinks into your mind, and then you try and see how you can apply that, what you've heard. And I think that makes a big difference.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Shravanam. So that's why Swamiji offers the courses. I mean, he's just indefatigable, and he's giving Shravanam over and over and over and over. And he creates situations for people to live 3 years and do nothing but this. There's nothing more beautiful than to sit and do this, because you're tapping the source of all your happiness. All right.
Thank you
all very much.
Thank you.